So I see you're on, Mick.
Hey, this is Mick. So I guess the question is, which meeting is this? Are we still on the fabric meeting, or are we ready to move on?
I think that fabric meeting is over. They've closed it.
Okay. I have three things on the agenda for today. Actually, well, four that I wanted to put on. I guess we can wait for just a couple more minutes since everybody's still arriving.
I threw a potential agenda item on chat there, happy to defer that if we've got a full load already.
Are you on Rocket Chat or which chat?
Yeah, on the architecture work group channel. Is that the right channel for this meeting?
Yep, exactly. So give it a couple more minutes. Hart, you're on today, right?
I sure am.
Okay. Because one of the things I wanted you to do is to go through the... I did a really bad job of explaining the game last time. So... and I'd like you to go through what we were talking about in Santa Clara.
Sure.
San Jose.
Yeah.
What about that? So, do you know, is Ron planning on being here today, or is he still out of town? He's been traveling for a while. So. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Number one, reminder that we have... all of the antitrust policies that are consistent with participating in any Hyperledger meeting. All of that is documented in the meeting notes. If you don't have a link to the notes, I will gladly send it out. Let me grab this. And it's now on the Rocket Chat channel. And again, just as a reminder, the document that we're working on, I will copy that as well and paste it in. Nothing has changed. All right, so feel free to add yourselves to the notes for today, for participation today. So first issue, I submitted a panel session for the Basel Forum in December, which the three names I put on it for the panel right now were myself, Hart, and Rahm, and that's only because that was the contact information that I had available to me when I was putting it in. I'd like to add probably two more people to that at least, and make sure that we cover the usage and requirements, and I think that would be Vipin, Stan, or Todd, given what we've been doing in the past. And then we need a little bit more on sort of the coverage of each of the platforms and what they're doing. So finding an appropriate representative that can talk on the sort of what Hyperledger has available to us. And I don't know if that's one of us or somebody else we can bring in on that. So that's number one. Number two, Todd is not here, right? You're not lurking someplace. All right. So we are working, Todd sent around a doodle poll for a face-to-face meeting end of August. If you have not received the doodle poll, let me or Todd know, and we'll get that to you I believe we were sort of converging on the week of August 27th. And that would be at the Oracle facility in in the San Jose area for that. Third thing, in preparation for that face-to-face, so the face-to-face will really be about getting as much as possible a complete draft of the paper completed. In preparation for that, one of the things, I think we've got the usage documentation from VPN, thank you very much. I think we've got the layout for the analysis pieces of it. And the piece that we still need is kind of a description of the privacy capability, privacy confidentiality capabilities for each of the platforms. So I'm going to add sections in for that. Dan, I don't know if you want to write up a paragraph or two about Sawtooth. I'll take care of the private data objects work and that class, which leaves us with really Aroha and Fabric. I will check with Ben to see if I can get him to write something for Fabric. Todd might be able to help as well. Stan, do you feel comfortable writing about one of the capabilities? And by the way, I have no idea what to do about Aroha. So,
you mean for one of the specific platforms?
Yeah. So I know you have some practical experience with it.
Well, the one I have the most practical, like hands-on experience would be Fabric, but I've dabbled a little bit with Aroha, but definitely not to the point of, to the level of being able to write up something coherent.
Okay. Yesterday, when they presented Aroha, status, they touched upon some of these points, and I asked them to be involved in the identity working group for the identity management piece because they were touting it as a great thing. And they also mentioned the whole scriptless script stuff, which may be related to the privacy confidentiality angle. I know that Dan just opened up a conversation with them about that. I don't know whether they're using the standard scriptless script stuff with the Schnorr signatures or something, or are they doing something else? But in either case, when we get in touch with them about the identity work, we can also mention this.
I've seen nothing in their architecture that's really focused, that appears to be focused on confidentiality architecturally. They may be using something with the keys and the encryption of the data, but it would be a good question to ask, and I'll track that down.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is that they mentioned that their documentation was out of step with whatever is public. So there seems to be some kind of a effort to re-engage with the community. I don't know why, but there is. So that could mean that they are, they could help us with these questions.
Okay. All right. I'll follow up and figure out who I should be asking about that and see if I can get just at least a little bit on what the, how they expect and the confidentiality issues to be addressed on it. Okay. So that was 3-4. And we brought this up when we met 2 weeks ago. And I horribly butchered the explanation of this. But we were trying to come up with, when we met in San Jose a few weeks ago, we were trying to come up with a way of doing a formal description of what it means to preserve confidentiality. And Hart proposed for us a way of doing this by sort of a game playing approach. And like I said, I did a horrible job explaining it last week. Hart, could you describe a little bit about what about the idea that you had for how to do the definition? And Dan, I think this would be a good time to bring up some of your questions.
Yeah, sure. So I don't know what exactly you guys discussed last week, and I'm sorry for missing the meeting. But basically the idea is, how do you model security in terms of privacy and confidentiality, right? It's kind of nebulous, and you have to mathematically quantify exactly what you mean. So what I did was I wrote up a game that basically allowed an adversary to kind of decide what they wanted to learn from the blockchain. And then essentially an adversary wins this kind of game if through normal blockchain interaction they can distinguish some private or confidential information. Did you actually show the game, Mick? Or did you just...
No, I just talked about how we went through it. I couldn't find the picture. I think Ron's got the picture of the board that we put together. So, which is why I was hoping he would be here today.
I mean, we can vaguely reconstruct it. So how many people here are familiar or comfortable with kind of cryptographic games?
I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I've been through them a bit.
Okay, so it's good that we at least have some people. So the basic idea is, for those of you that are not familiar, think about how we define, say, CPA secure encryption, right? Or even CCA secure encryption. We define it as a game where an adversary gets, say, encryptions of two messages, is allowed to ask someone to encrypt arbitrary messages for them, and then has to decide, whether a challenge message is, say, one of two messages of his choice or something like that, right? I realize this is probably very hard to think about without the thing in writing. Should we take a stab at trying to maybe write this?
Sure. Do you want to just put it in the notes and then copy it in? And I know you, when we worked on it in San Jose, we started with the Red Blue Marble game to do that. And that made it a lot easier for me to grok it. If you want to, just go through that?
Yeah. So do you want to explain to everyone what the Red Blue Marble game is?
Go ahead.
I said, do you want to?
I know, I already butchered it badly.
We already got to hear Mick's rendition last week.
It was pretty bad.
But we can hear yours.
Okay.
I kept looking for that stupid picture so I could actually explain it, but...
Well, Mick, you know what they say, if you can't explain it, it means that you didn't understand it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So
this is why I'm pointing to Hart for this. And that being said, this approach of it, just my take on this, and this is why I connected it to what Dan's question is that one of the things that's very challenging in this space is what is privacy and what is confidentiality? And without some more formal representation for it, it's very difficult to do any kind of analysis that's anything better than anecdotal, right? And so this seemed to be a way of actually putting some meat on a formal definition that we could actually use to apply. That was why I was interested in it.
Yeah. Right. So I guess we should stick with the marble case. So suppose we have a blockchain around trading marbles of different colors. How many different colors do we want here? Vic?
Two.
Okay. What are your two favorite colors?
Blue and red.
All right. So we have a blockchain based around trading marbles of different colors. And we're going to consider this in kind of a very, very strong model. So we're going to give the adversary kind of all possible powers, right? So what we basically want, right? So I'm kind of writing this up in the notes as we go along. So, and please interrupt me if you have questions. I'm recreating this on the fly without notes. So there might be mistakes.
Yeah. And we do, by the way, Hart, we do have the copies of the adversarial models in the paper already if we want to just copy something out of there.
Where?
About page 2 in the paper. Adversarial power assumption option.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
Let me just copy those over and you can pack them.
And this is a good thing to discuss first. So we define this, I guess, this is what we wrote up when we met at Cisco.
Correct.
So we defined a bunch of adversarial power options. And this is kind of the most important thing you want to, well, I don't know if the most important. This is one of the most important things when you're considering privacy and confidentiality is to define exactly how powerful you expect your adversary to be. Because this will, if you make your adversary too strong, then you're sort of wasting resources. And if you make your adversary too weak, then you potentially are not modeling him or her correctly and are making yourself vulnerable to a security breach. And so these are some typical adversarial assumptions. So in general, we have what's called an adaptive adversary and a selective adversary. So for blockchain, an adaptive adversary can adaptively control up to k fraction of nodes on the network as the blockchain is running. So you all are kind of familiar with, the Bitcoin guarantee or the Byzantine fault tolerant guarantee, where we say that a system is secure as long as an adversary controls like a K fraction of nodes on the network, right? You guys are all familiar with that?
Yep. Yep.
So there are two kinds of ways the adversary can do this, right? In one model, the adversary is forced to declare at the beginning of time which nodes he's going to corrupt. So say at the beginning of the blockchain or at some point early in the blockchain before we start playing privacy and confidentiality protocols, the adversary has to decide which nodes to corrupt. And that's kind of the weaker model. The stronger model is that the adversary can sort of adaptively corrupt nodes. So if some node is, say, particularly important or something like that, the adversary can choose to corrupt that one. And that obviously gives the adversary more power. So kind of deciding which of these models is right for your security is important, because you'll need much, much more powerful and heavyweight techniques to achieve security in an adaptive model than you will in a selective model. Is that clear? Does everybody understand that?
Yeah, I might have some thoughts about making that harder, but please go on.
Making it harder?
Yeah, let me not knock you off track, though.
Please. No, that's fine. It's good to discuss this.
Just that with the whole immutable ledger concept, maybe it's conceivable that the adversary can rewind even if he hasn't controlled nodes at the outset.
Rewind? What do you mean by that?
You could play back all the traffic that happened. So even if you didn't control a node initially, maybe that's not as much of a consideration in this kind of communication.
Well, but the adaptive case already takes that into account, right?
Yeah, that falls under the adaptive adversary, right?
Sure.
Vipin's correct. And then we also define the adversarial power options for the network communication. So kind of the default assumption is that an adversary can see all communications. And I want to point out, this does not prevent users from encrypting data or other methods of data obfuscation, but just means the adversary can watch the channel between the participants, right? So if I send Dan a message on the blockchain, you know, it means that an adversary might not be able to tell what was being sent, but just notices the presence of a message. Is this clear?
Yes.
Yeah. And so this is necessary for universal composability in general. And, you know, for some blockchain use cases, this might be, you know, this might be what you have to choose, right? In fact, for many applications, right, you know, you're broadcasting your transactions on the blockchain to everyone. So this is kind of the default assumption for most blockchains. So there's another potential adversary model for this, where we can assume that an adversary knows when all messages are sent, but doesn't know certain characteristics about the traffic. So like the size of the message, for instance, or things like that, right? So this you can model if you say are only posting hashes on the blockchain, right? Because then the adversary knows that something's happening, but might not know like the exact size of the message or the characteristics of the payload or stuff like that. And then the third model is that the adversary can't see any messages that are not from a party controlled by the adversary. And this is a very, very, I don't know if this is realistic. This is probably only realistic if you have private channels, like a private wire between all parties. So does this make sense? Are you guys comfortable with these assumptions?
Yep. I'm all excited to hear about marbles.
Any questions before we go on to marbles? I'll be sure to bring you some marbles for the member summit, Dan.
That'd be great, but only if we can trade them in secret.
Yeah.
I think I've lost all my marbles.
All right. So I don't interrupt you in a minute, though. I unfortunately ended up with a conflict halfway through. Would anybody mind if we record the second half of the meeting so that I can catch up out of band?
I believe all of these are recorded anyway. I don't know if I can get the recording.
I think you might have to manually click record on the Zoom.
Right, but yeah. But if you look in the upper left, it says it's recording already.
Oh, true.
So okay. I believe they're all recorded. I don't know if they're recorded. I don't know where they end up when they get recorded.
I think maybe Rye or somebody has to go in and split the recording during the day because he had asked for like start and stop times.
Yeah, the recording.
Yeah, so I'll. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just gonna say I'll send a note to Rye right now and just ask him where they end up.
Thank you.
Right. Sooner or later, they're supposed to be posted up against each working group. I know that it does happen with the identity working group. We have the meeting minutes and we have the recordings, but somebody has to do it. Of course, it doesn't get done right away. I don't know whether we can write a script that'll do it, but that's a different story.
Yeah, let's hard keep going. I'll take care of that one.
Okay. So now that we have kind of our adversarial model, and we're clear on that, so we're going to consider the kind of strongest adversarial model today. The adversary can actively and adaptively control up to a K fraction of nodes on the network and can see all communications. And I guess, Mick, do you remember what exactly, what transactions we defined around this, around our marble trading?
Again, we were focusing on confidentiality. I thought we basically said that person A transfers or participant A transfers some set of marbles to participant B, and the game was the attacker has to figure out what color they were?
Yes.
It was something as simple as that, right?
All right. We'll keep it. We'll try to keep it really simple, right? So we're going to have N parties, and then, right, adversary can adaptively corrupt K, right?
Correct.
So here's how the game is going to go, right? If I recall, the adversary can request, so we run like, there's a blockchain setup algorithm, right? We run that, right?
Yep.
Then I guess, sort of while adversary, so basically the first step of the game, the adversary can request, so I should say we're going to start with N parties. Initially, all N parties are what's called honest, not corrupted by the adversary, okay? So we have a totally honest blockchain network, right? So the adversary can do the following things. Okay. What can an adversary do? Can people tell me?
Watch messages.
Well, we're giving him more power.
Fine.
So the adversary can corrupt an honest party. It can request. It can issue transactions from nodes from parties it controls, right? And we're going to give it kind of a ton of power. Right?
When you say its choice, who's the it there?
Adversaries.
The adversaries. Good. So basically, so in the game, and this is, you know, stronger than kind of any reasonable blockchain, the adversary is allowed to get honest parties to make transactions. And you may ask, why do we do this? Well, we do this because in the real world, an adversary might have some way to trick people or to influence people into making certain transactions, right? And so if we don't have this functionality, then our blockchain protocol is probably not reasonable, at least in terms of security. Right? So the adversary can corrupt an honest party, it can issue transactions from parties it controls, and it can request an honest party to initiate a transaction of its choice. All right? And we'll say any polynomial number of operations, right? Then at some point, we should also define a transaction rule set. So the transactions we're going to consider are just sending or trading red marbles and blue marbles, right? At some point, the adversary picks two possible transactions. Right? And we'll restrict between two parties. Are you guys following along in the text?
Following along in the text, yes.
Yes.
So what we're getting to is kind of the challenge phase. So at some point, the adversary is going to pick two possible transactions and two honest nodes. So the challenger, or kind of the person running the game, will say transactions T1 and T2 and two honest nodes, right? I should say it should be T0 and T1, right? The challenger who's running the game will choose a random bit B, okay? And then the two honest nodes will run TB, okay? And then we have once, what is going on with my?
The text you've been typing recently is not showing up for me.
So did I get, what's the last thing you saw?
The transaction types.
Okay.
Are you an anonymous badger?
I have no idea. Google Docs is not.
Freaking out on you?
Yeah, I'm going to reload the document.
Okay. I was going to say either that or just send me a copy of the text and or paste it into the Hyperledger chat and I'll copy it in. I'd rather not lose what you wrote.
Okay, so yeah. So at some point, there we go. And why did this once again in there?
Hey, just all popped up.
Whoa, now it's looking really weird for me.
Okay, well, I actually, in this case, I'm seeing what you've been writing, so.
Okay.
I think we have it
in the doc, yeah.
Okay, sorry for this. Why is this? Okay, so it got pasted in 5, 6, 7. That can be deleted, right? That's just the same thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Now it's 6, 7, 8. Oh, can somebody reformat? Sorry, my doc is just it's just messed up. I don't know if it's looking that way for everybody else.
That was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can delete that.
Okay, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 showing up on the at some point. Last thing I have in there is 2 honest nodes will run T underscore B.
Yeah, that's the last thing I wrote.
Okay.
The previous page is getting kind of weird, but I think it looks, there we go. I don't know what happened there.
The joys of Google Doc.
I hope I haven't made any mistakes in this, but so once again, so we're going to let the adversary do things again. So once again, it can continue to corrupt parties. Right. So it gets to do this game. It gets to see this challenge query, right? And we, well, it's going to, Right.
Yep.
So. Otherwise,
what's the point?
Yeah. So basically, if the adversary can corrupt the nodes that had made the transaction, or make a transaction that's dependent on that, right? Then it's kind of useless, right? There's no point in the security game is meaningless. If you're familiar with kind of CCA encryption, then this is essentially what we're using, right?
And the point of that restriction is basically that there's no point in talking about security between already corrupted parties. It's really, can you take the corrupted parties and break the security of the honest parties?
Yeah. All right.
So you've been at some spending point, too much time with LaTeX.
Welcome. Well, the last 15 years of my life. Sometimes when I get really tired, at least when I was in school, I would take notes in a math class and I would write tech on pencil and paper.
Oh, that's bad. So the gist of this last one is that there has to be some advantage, right? You can't just, kind of flip a coin and get lucky. The epsilon is really the, okay, prove that you really did it as opposed to prove that you were just really lucky, right?
Right. So we want to be separate from a half, right? So, an adversary is useful if epsilon is non-negligible. So if epsilon is like more than 1 over polynomial for some inverse polynomial in the security parameter.
And if epsilon is positive, right? Epsilon is meant to be positive.
It's what?
Meant to be positive, right?
Well, yeah. So, oh, epsilon, yes.
Otherwise, it would be like, all, after all this attacking, the adversaries guessing less than half.
So it turns out, Vipin, that if you get it, if you, as long as you're far away from a half, you're okay, right? If you guess wrong, like if you can somehow guess wrong with non-negligible advantage, then you can just flip your answer and guess right with non-negligible advantage, right? So as long as you're as long as you're bounded from random,
you're I get it.
So I guess that's the game, and I've probably missed something, but we should go over it. So do people kind of understand what's going on here? So basically, phase one, right? The adversary can do, or I should say, phase one is blockchain setup, but then phase two, the adversary can do kind of all of the following things. It can corrupt parties, it can issue transactions from parties it can it controls, and it can request an honest party to, you know, to initiate a transaction of its choice, right? And then kind of after the challenge phase, the adversary can also do essentially the same things, right? And in the middle, the adversary picks two possible transactions and two honest nodes that involve the transaction. The challenger chooses a random bit B and the two honest nodes run TB. So basically this is saying the adversary knows that two possible transactions occurred, right? And he has to try to distinguish which one occurred, right? And he's allowed a lot of power in terms of observing the blockchain to try to figure this out.
So to make this more concrete, if we went back and we basically said our transactional model is you're only allowed to transfer marbles of one color.
Right.
And then the bit B might be, can you determine what color marble was transferred in the transaction?
Yes. So right. So we could simplify this and say the transaction rule, right, is you can send send a red marble or a blue marble, right? Or a blue marble from one party to another, right?
Right.
So it can, so the issue transactions, it can send a marble of either color to a party of its choice from one of its nodes, right? Right. Right. So we can say T0, send red marble. Right. Something like this, right?
So, can we stop here for just a second? I want to go back to the Stan, Vipin, Sonia, and others. Does this make sense as a gross simplification of the kind of problems we were seeing in the usages? To you.
To me, this looks like a great model to test the privacy and confidentiality against. I am not 100% sure how to map this to the initial problem of factoring.
Okay.
Unless we go really deep down into the individual messages and transactions.
Right. Okay. So starting with this as a simplification is okay with you, but we really need to talk about how it also applies to more complex issues. How can be generalized to more complex problems? Pippin, what's your thinking?
I mean, as a model, this is, you know, basically about concealing the information, right? I mean, it's not about anything very general. It is about reducing the problem into a very simple thing, that is, whether you can guess with more than 50% certainty, given the powers that you have, of transactions that are happening between people whose nodes you do not control. So it's, you know, in that sense, yes, the model, you know, will tell you whether, I mean, will help you think about this particular problem, whether that particular problem can then be generalized to the factoring problem. Probably can be after, you know, reducing the problem to its very core elements. But I haven't given it a thought. I'm just looking, you know, I'm just following along this game or this model setup right now. And then where are we going with this in terms of, so this is just a model which says, okay, the adversary has all of these powers. Then you have two honest nodes that are exchanging data. And if the adversary can then guess with more than 50% or less than 50% certainty, then you are, you know, not 50% after playing this game for hundreds of rounds. I mean, it has to be obviously probabilistically relevant, right? I mean, so it has to be scaled up to multiple rounds. Now, I think it's useful, you know, let's go along with this for a minute.
Yeah. Okay. So, Tanya, I'm not going to let you lurk too long.
I'm just trying to catch up. Thank you.
Okay.
Healthcare is complex, though. That's why this matters a lot. And this is going to be the biggest challenge in healthcare, is this piece.
Okay.
So Vipin, kind of to your point, what this game is modeled to do is that if an adversary can learn anything essentially about transactions on the blockchain, then it can win this game, right? Because it essentially gets to pick what it's trying to target, right? So if it can learn anything about any transaction that it shouldn't, then it can pick that transaction, right, to learn about. So you don't actually have to play this game in a ton of sequence. We've written it in a strong enough way that if an adversary can learn anything, then it can win the game. Does that make sense?
So are you saying that you can learn whether whether an epsilon exists just by playing once?
No. Sorry if I wasn't clear there. So I was saying that so it doesn't matter which part of information an adversary can learn on the blockchain. As if it can learn any information, then it can win the game. And the epsilon is going to be a cryptographic parameter. So what we're going to want to say is we're going to want to show kind of a reduction that says that the adversary can win the game with advantage, 1/2 plus like 2^-128 or something like that, where the 2^-128 is the adversary's chance of breaking our cryptographic protocols.
Hey, I got a question.
Yeah.
So where does the question of like, how does this probability of an adversary winning increase with subsequent round fit? Right. So if, because this describes a single round. Now, say the second round, is, are we saying that the system is like secure if the probability does not change?
So this is a one round game. Why would you need multiple rounds?
Well, it's, you may learn from losing.
I don't think you would, you shouldn't be able to learn from losing, right?
Well, so that's another assumption, that you shouldn't be able to learn from losing.
I think this is implicit in the game.
Okay. All right, that's fine.
So it will refresh kind of, yeah, it's just a one round game, and I don't think you need a multiple round game. Sorry about that.
Okay, sounds fair.
Because if you want to kind of have the adversary learn something, and have a multi round game, you can model that by corrupting a party, and then kind of pushing your TB to a later state, right?
What do you mean by later state?
Or just later. So, right. I mean, fundamentally, what the first stage is, right, is kind of is just the blockchain running, right?
Yeah.
And the last stage is kind of the blockchain running again, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the block. So you can kind of summarize this, right? The blockchain runs. The adversary has to sees a transaction that it has to learn about, and then the blockchain runs again, right?
Oh, I got it. Makes sense.
So I should probably write that, but. But yeah, so if you really want to have kind of a multi-round game, you can essentially simulate that with just having the blockchain run more, I think.
I think my question is, how can you talk about probability without multiple rounds?
Why do you need multiple rounds?
So, because like Stan said, you could guess and be right, or guess and be wrong. So,
but how do you, how Vipin, how are you ever going to verify your guess, right, in practice? In practice, if I don't corrupt those nodes, I kind of never know whether I guessed right or wrong, right?
So how exactly in the construction of the game, when you do this epsilon thing, how exactly are we going to figure out, how exactly is the adversary going to figure out if they guessed right or wrong?
They're not.
I think the point of the epsilon is that you don't know, but you have some confidence interval. Just as a concrete example, if the blue marble transactions, if 75% of the time a blue marble transaction is bigger than a red marble transaction, then the adversary may be able to look at the size of the transaction message, guess that it's a red marble, and with some probability be right based on that information. So no, that would be a form of probabilistic leaking of the information.
So that's not, I mean, what we really mean. So what we really mean in the epsilon is that, so Vipin, right? So we're going to be, you know, ideally, right, we want the adversary's guess to be totally random, right? We want it to be like a half, right? Yeah. That would be the case in the ideal world. So the epsilon gives us a very, very small amount of wiggle room, right? So ideally we want it to be a half, but you know, suppose there's the chance that like Mick could guess my cryptographic key, right? If he got really, really, really unfathomably lucky, right? And then if he guessed that, then he could probably win this game, right? And that's kind of what the epsilon accounts for, is it accounts for a bunch of extremely small possibilities that might bias the outcome. So in practice, epsilon will be something, I should write this. We want to set epsilon to something like 2 to the minus 128, something incredibly small, right? It's like the chance of someone breaking our cryptography. Does that make sense?
Why is it small?
Why?
Yeah.
Because we don't want the adversary to tell whether we sent a red, or we don't want the adversary to be able to distinguish between transactions of red and blue marbles, right?
Well, isn't the epsilon sort of a measure of acceptable risk?
No.
So a random guess. So we've got a red marble, blue marble. So we have two choices.
Right. A random guess is probability a half, right?
Is exactly a half, right?
Yes.
So
so I'm saying you shouldn't.
If you win with 2 to the minus 128, I mean, if your epsilon is 2 to the minus 128, that means that you're better than random guess almost never.
Yes, that's exactly what we want.
Okay, so for the purposes of evaluating threat, doesn't the epsilon sort of represent the probability of the attacker being able to get it right?
Yes, essentially.
So what we're really saying with epsilon of 2 to the minus 128 is all you got to do is get it right very, 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 very infrequently in order to break it. But it does mean that something was exposed.
So we say the adversary wins the game with advantage epsilon. I should redefine this. We'll say the adversary has advantage epsilon if B equals B prime with probability at least 1/2 plus epsilon, right? And then we say the adversary wins the game if if they have advantage epsilon, if they have non-negligible epsilon, right?
So where's the assumption that adversary doesn't know that they won come in?
What do you mean? The assumption that the adversary does not know that they won?
Yes.
Well, we're never telling the adversary whether they won, right?
So they're, well, right, obviously, but they're not able to figure this out because they elicit a transaction.
Yeah, but if they can figure it out, then they're learning it anyway, right? So kind of if they're getting the information, whether they won or not, then they learned the information on the transaction anyway, right? So if they have some channel where they can see if they won or not, then the whole kind of security game is not so meaningful, right? Because then they could have just learned it anyway, right?
Right. Well, but this is in case of a, 50-50 guessing game. If we're talking about more significant payload, that kind of becomes less of an issue. even if we take that there, colors, you know, let's extend to, you know, RGB.
Mm-hmm.
So then being able to learn doesn't really, that you guessed it right, doesn't really necessarily give you any advantage for the subsequent rounds.
Well, I mean, in a new round, you'd be resetting everything, right? So you're running blockchain setup, right, in the game. So
yeah.
If you played this game multiple rounds, you'd be running it on a completely different blockchain, right? So presumably, like, your cryptographic keys and everything else wouldn't carry over.
On a new blockchain, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Hey, by the way, we are at 9 o'clock. So, well, at time, I think, for Vipin, it's noon, right?
Lunchtime.
Should we continue this next time?
Sure.
All right.
Sounds good.
If you guys have any questions or comments on this.
Do you have a write-up of this somewhere, Hart?
Not any more than right here. I mean, there's a picture of what I wrote on the board with.
So you basically
created this game.
Yeah.
On the spur of the moment.
Yeah. And okay. So if you're proving security of a blockchain, right, you're going to have to kind of come up with this game yourself for your blockchain, right? The way I've written this game, it's extremely strong. If you think about it, it gives the adversary a ton of power, and in your blockchain, they might not have this much power.
Okay.
So.
Until next time, then.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Good discussion. Thanks, Hart.
You're welcome. Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Hey,
thank you. Bye.
Hey, Mick.
Yep.
Is there a deadline for when we're going to make the call for the meeting date?
Yeah, you're talking about the one in Redmond. Let me bug Todd again and find out. I thought he'd be on today. So. Okay.
Well, because Todd actually responded to the poll, so.
He did or did not? I didn't see anything.
He did.
Okay, I'll have to go back and figure out where I lost that message.
Well, as in, actually, on Doodle, he's
showing up
as. Yeah.
As confirming it? Okay, because I had not gone back to look at the Doodle poll. I'll go back and do that, and I will confirm with Todd and send something around.
So, Ron and Hart aren't there? And
I didn't vote because I don't think I can make it over there. So I didn't want to corrupt the vote with a non-participant vote. Which,
okay.
Meaning, you know, I can't do it anyway. So.
Yep, I got it. But I'll go bug Todd and make sure that we're confirmed for a time, and either have him send it around or I'll send it around.
Sounds good.
It's just been so much more effective to have everybody in a room on accomplishing these things. So,
yeah, I get it, Mick. I mean, this is the problem I'm having with the identity working group. The participants are much more global than in other working groups.
Right.
In the identity working group, there are people from, you know, from India, from Europe, from Asia. It becomes very, very difficult. So the only other way that we have seen in the identity piece, at least, is to write up something and then we can, you know, either work on it, shorten it, whatever. All right. I think we are up and the recording should stop. And I don't know how. He had sent around keys. Did you get them, Mick?
Yeah, but what exactly are they for?
You're supposed to take over the host. I think this is his intention, that they don't want to be on every call, pressing record and pressing stop record.
Yeah, I have a feeling that we just continued the recording from the last one.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I sent a note to Rai on this.
Yeah, we got to have some kind of automated way, or the host has to actually take control of the meeting with the host key and then, you know, do the record, under-record and all that. So I don't think it's, anyway, now new people are showing up, which means there's next meeting.
Okay. All right. Well, let me see if I can actually stop the recording on this one.
You need the host key for that, I think. Anyway.
Yeah, he sent it to me, but I'm not listed as a meeting host, so I'll have to figure out. Okay, I'll talk to Ryan and figure out exactly what I'm supposed to do to make that work. So, all right, time to go.
Yep. Thanks, Mick.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye.